Am I allowed to bring my drink up a...
Only if it's vodka.
Nope. All right, this is at a slant, so I'm going to set it over there. Good evening. My name's Clinton Rackley. I'm a drug addict. I just told you my last name, so I guess that blows that. But I get into the habit of saying my last name. My sponsor thinks that we have anonymity outside the rooms, but inside the rooms, we don't really practice that. That's his belief. He also says that we should wear a suit when we speak, so that's the... I'd rather be up here in sweatpants, but yeah, my name is Clinton Rackley. I'm a drug addict. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, and I don't have the greatest story. I don't have the most interesting story, and you're probably not going to cry or anything like that. But we flew all the way from Arizona, so this is what you're going to get. So whether you like it or not, nobody told me how long we're going to go. Maybe a half hour, something like that. So, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I'll see you guys outside vaping in 40 minutes. But whatever the case, I saw some of you guys' vapes. Somebody's out there vaping. It looked like a keg right out there on the registration table. We're vapers, but not like that. So whatever the case, yeah, we are happy to come here. You know, we do travel a lot. We last month we went to the conference for Cocaine Anonymous. We're big-time CA people, which was in Los Angeles, and we made a bid for Southwest Regional, which you guys are part of, and we won that bid. And so the World Convention for Cocaine Anonymous internationally is going to be in Phoenix in 2025, and that's pretty exciting. Yeah, no big deal. Next year, obviously, it got all messed up because of COVID-19. It was supposed to be in Austin last year, and it was supposed to be in New York City coming up. But now it's all switched around. So next year, it'll be in Austin, Texas, and in 2022. And then in 2023, it's going to Atlanta, Georgia. 2024, we're going to the Netherlands, Amsterdam, where we'll have like 50% relapse rate probably for everybody. So I don't know whose idea that was. But and then in 2025, it's coming back here. So if you've been, we go to all the conventions. We've done the Family Feud, the Crackhead Family Feud. We've done that at a bunch of the conventions. Super fun. And we did it at some of the world conventions. If you've been around that long, in Las Vegas, we had in 2015, that was where the world convention was. We had like, you know, 50% relapse right there. So that was people picking up their newcomer's chip. I was like, you had a decade sober yesterday. But it was interesting nonetheless, though. That was actually a great convention. We had a lot of fun there. So we'll see what happens in Amsterdam. So, well, hopefully we'll see you guys all there. Super uncomfortable in this. But anyways, yeah. I always start out all of my shares, no matter if it's with a sponsee, and I want to tell them that Cocaine Anonymous is the greatest fellowship that has ever been created, including Christianity. And everybody's just like, wait a second, what about Christ? So, no, not my thing, but I do believe in God. I do believe that Cocaine Anonymous is the greatest fellowship of all time. It is so inclusive. It is so. See, we already lost one. How dare you? One down, 60 to go. Cocaine Anonymous is just the most all-encompassing fellowship, and we didn't really need it. You know, back in 1935, you know, the big book was written, official printing in 1939, and everybody was happy with Alcoholics Anonymous. And no, I wasn't born then. I don't think any of us were born back in 1939, but we know how that guy was. Not quite. But we, you know, those of us who are big book thumpers and who are, you know, history buffs, we know all about that stuff, and we read all about it constantly, and we know that that back then Alcoholics Anonymous was it, and it was the greatest fellowship that had ever been created for people who want to get sober. But what something happened with the drug addicts, and it started happening a lot. For newly developed recovery places, even in my time, when you know I've been sober 11 years, my sobriety date is 42410, so I've been sober 11 years, 5 months, and a week, not to be exact, but that's yeah. No marijuana maintenance, no sneaky LSD, nothing weird, nothing. I believe that sobriety is sobriety, and that's that. You know, all these guys running around on methadone, he's like, you think I'm sober? It's like, oh my goodness. So anyways, so Alcoholics Anonymous, they started steering into the singleness of purpose. And a lot of drug addicts did not like that because they were shutting us down. They say, oh, you can't talk about dope at this meeting. Well, I had cocaine and this, that, and the other. And they're like, oh, you get out of here. You be quiet. And that was my experience, you know, back in 2003 when I first tried to get sober, long before my sobriety date. I went to a lot of meetings out in Chandler, Arizona, GIT. I think it stands for Get It Together, is that right? And there was a Road to Recovery in a couple of different places. And I went to the really early meetings, and there was, some of these older guys were there, and they gave me all those, put the plug in the jug. And they would tell me things, I spilled more liquor than you drank, and all these crazy little things. And they would come up with these little one-liners like, let go and let God, think. And I was like, these guys are out of their fucking minds. I was like, none of this makes any sense. I don't want to hear another word of it. And back then in 1959, actually it was 1953 that Narcotics Anonymous started. And it kind of went up and down for about 6 years. And welcome. And then in 1959 is when it really took hold. Narcotics Anonymous became an official fellowship, and they got their own book. But those of us who were big book thumpers, those of them who were big book thumpers back then, they realized that they weren't using the big book. And we didn't like that because we were big book people. And so in 1982, they started Cocaine Anonymous in Los Angeles, Long Beach, and it became what it is today. And in my opinion, there's no other need for anything else because Cocaine Anonymous is all-encompassing. You can use whatever drugs you want and still feel welcome here. We prefer that you stop using them, but whatever the case. So that's my spiel on Cocaine Anonymous. It's the greatest fellowship there is. That's why I do all Cocaine Anonymous. I am grateful for AA because it did introduce me to the program. Back in 2003, I went to my first AA meeting ever. And it wasn't because everything was going good in my life. Everything was going super shitty. And I came home from work one day, and my I've owned a business for decades. And we had this big, cool house in Belcourt Manor. And I came home on a Thursday afternoon, and the whole house was empty. And I thought we got robbed. And I called my wife to tell her I got robbed, and she goes, no, I got all your shit, and I'm heading to Tucson. And I was like, oh, so that's a whole nother thing. So she... Yeah, she took off. She goes, yeah. And it's the first time anybody had ever said anything to me about it. She says, you're an alcoholic. And it's the first time anybody's ever said it. I was like, wow, this is all the notice I get? I mean, there's no second chance. I mean, are you sure? And I thought she was grossly overreacting. She says, you need to go to an AA meeting and a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I said, well, alcoholics? I never heard of it in my life, but it sounded terrific. Alcoholics Anonymous, people who drink a lot, don't want anybody to know. I thought that's what that meant. I'm not kidding. I thought that's what that was all about. It's like a secret drinking group where we all don't talk shit and nobody tells you not to have another. And I was like, this is my place. So I went on to my AOL dial-up. And it started loading. You know, some of you are too young to know this, but back then the internet was not what it is today, and it took all day. And so it started downloading, and it got to about 2 inches down the page, and the first meeting on there was at this place called Bloopers, and I couldn't wait anymore because it took 80 minutes for it to download just to that far. Alcoholics Anonymous Bloopers. So I dressed up. I'm a big Harley guy. I love Harley Davidsons. I got one in the garage. I've always had a Harley except for the time when I was outlawed against riding him in Arizona, which is a whole nother ball game. But whatever the case, so I figured I'd want to impress my friends. So I got dressed up in the leather. I got the whole thing on. I rolled down there. And I marched up, got right on the front row. There's about 100 people there at this meeting. I went right up to the front row, got myself a seat. They started doing the little thing. They passed the basket. I put 10 bucks in there, looked around, make sure somebody saw me. And I was like, I had no idea what it was. You know, I was just like, what are we donating money for? I was like, I better throw a 10 in there. And I looked over there, saw somebody throwing a 1. I was like, yeah, I better throw in 10. You know, because we're so fucked up. You know, we don't even understand value at that point and what creates a person's self-esteem. And it was a disaster. But whatever the case, I started bawling during the reading of the steps, because they started going through the steps and describing an alcoholic, and he started doing all the reading, and then the speaker came up there, and I started crying worse, and it was absolutely uncontrollable. I made a complete fool out of myself, and when I left there, everybody was hugging me, and they were just like, oh, is this your first meeting? And some lady came up to me, and she goes, oh, did she leave? And I was like, what kind of mind-reading witchcraft? How did they know this kind of stuff? I could not believe it. And I left there. And on the way home, I was riding a Harley. I was like, tears coming out. And I was just like, I'm never going back there again. Isn't that sick? It makes me sad just thinking about it. Because why was that my first thought? I never want to go there again. It made me feel uncomfortable. I was so unhappy. And that was November 1st, 2003. And it would be another 7 years before I ever even got sober. Because it was that weird attitude of I'm not good enough. And a multiple of other things that are described in the big book, like how we describe 1,000 different ways to prove ourselves an exception to the rule. And that was another one for me. So, but, you know, fast forward to last month, here we are at the World Convention bidding on the World Convention for Cocaine Anonymous. And it was one of the happiest times ever. I wore a cactus suit. Now, I did that for you guys so that you could win the... So we could win the World Convention. We had a T-shirt launcher, the whole nine yards. Everybody was just like, "Oh my God, settle down!" And it was a great time. But I wouldn't be able to do stuff like that. I wouldn't be able to come here. I wouldn't be able to travel. A couple months ago, we went scuba diving for the first time. And I don't know if you've ever done that before, but that is super weird. And you can breathe underwater with air tanks. And we did that in Mexico. Life is fabulous, but looking back to what it took to get there, it's not a pretty situation, and there's a lot of things I could blame it on. You know, we look back at our childhood. I've sponsored a lot of guys, dozens and dozens of guys, and some of the things you hear a lot are things that I said. You know, my childhood was messed up, and I just don't believe that. I believe that I was predisposed to become an alcoholic. And when I was given the opportunity, I took it by the reins. And I drank as much as I possibly could. I don't think I was potty trained backwards. I don't think that my dad maybe sit on the toilet facing the bowl or anything weird. I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness, and that was weird. So I'm kind of like recovering from that a little bit too. I'm a recovering Jehovah's Witness. That's a pretty weird religion to grow up in, but I don't think it made me an alcoholic. I really don't. It's not an easy religion. You don't celebrate any holidays. You don't celebrate Halloween. You don't get to celebrate your birthday. I celebrated my first birthday just a few years ago, and I'm 50. You know, I'm 50 today, and I've celebrated my first Christmas in sobriety, which is super weird. But they threw me out for drinking, and they wrote on there that I was morally deficient on my expulsion papers. And I was like, morally deficient. They're just like, yes, you're too far to save, my friend. And they were like, you don't even want to quit drinking. And I was just like, well, yeah, that's true. So, and that's really how I read the third step, or the third tradition. The only desire for membership is a desire to quit drinking so much. I didn't want to drink so much, but I didn't want to stop. For a long time, I thought when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that there were people that were drinking. I did not believe them, that they were sober. And that was the way it was with Cocaine Anonymous for a long time as well. I did not believe that these people were actually clean. And it took a long time to get that through my head. So whatever the case, my first experience with rehab was in 2004. I've been to rehab 12 times. The first few times is pretty good because you get to go and you get to have the nice insurance. Back when I had insurance, I got to go to Betty Ford a couple times, and that was a great experience. It had nothing to do with getting sober, but I had my own robe. It had my little thing on the initials, monogram. That's what you call it, the monogram. Now I get up in the morning, I pick up the little phone, and it was one of those neat-looking, old-fashioned phones, and they'd be like, "What for breakfast, sir?" And I'd be like, "I don't know, croissant." And they're like, "Oh, coming right up." And they bring it in. Yeah, meanwhile, the guy across the bedroom, he's doing cocaine, you know, and I was like, are we supposed to get sober here? And he goes, "Oh, get real, bro." And then I got to go to Valley Hope a couple times, but after a while, the insurance runs out. And the insurance company tells you to go fuck yourself, and your family tells you to go fuck yourself, and they don't want to pay $100,000 for your rehab or $40,000 or any other grand. And so then I started getting drug into these weird little detox places. And back then we had this place called Lark, and we had another place called Evac. Now they call them Community Bridges. They dressed it up a little bit. They put some lipstick on that filthy pig. But yeah, I bet you got some of those here, these detox centers with the concrete floors and the rubber mattresses and everything. Yeah, I went to those a lot. And my aunt took me to Evac so many times, which was in Mesa, that they knew me. They would go, "Oh, hey, Clinton, yes, bring him over here, lay him in the corner." And I was just like, you don't know me, you don't understand. You know, completely shit-faced on Jägermeister and Red Bull and whatever else was going on at the time. So I actually made one attempt to get sober. So, and this is kind of, I think, where the awakening started. In 2004, 2005, I actually made one good attempt to get sober. And then I went to the rehab. I stayed sober for about 4 months, and they sent me to, afterward, to this IOP. Which I think stands for doesn't fucking work. But I went, you know, it's 3 hours a night, three times a week. And no, if you're an IOP, please don't listen to that. So, you go, boy. But what a joke. So I went to these IOP classes 3 hours a night. And this is going to sound crazy to you guys, but you know, I'm 35 years old at this point, 30-something years old, and I had never done drugs in my life up to that point. Never. Raised a Jehovah's Witness, you know? But I was drinking a couple fifths a day of Jack Daniels and vodka, whatever was available. But in IOP, I met some new distinguished colleagues, and these people were a cut above. And so I met, you know, they were like, "Oh, you just do alcohol?" I said, "I've never done any drugs in my life." And they're like, "Oh, where you live?" And I'll be like, "Oh, I live in Belcourt Manor down here." They're, "Oh, yeah, that's a nice place. You got a bedroom?" "Oh, yeah, I got 6 bedrooms, 5 baths." And they're like, next thing you know, they're, "Oh, my wife's being a bitch. Can I just stay here tonight?" And I'd be like, "Oh, Jim?" And he's like, yeah, you know me from IOP. He's got the wife beater on, sweaty as fuck. He comes in there. I was just like, "Hey, you know, come on in. We're all going to get sober together, right?" Because that was everybody was just like, "We're all going to get sober together. We're going to stay friends forever." You never see these people again. You know, all these, we're sitting around the circle smoking our little cigarettes, and everybody's just like, "Oh, yeah, I'm just going to get my kids back. Oh, yeah, we're going to stay in touch." And you never see him again, you know. Thank God, too. So Jim comes in. I told Jim, "Come on in the house." And a couple days went by, and I was just like, I was starting to see some things. I was just like, "Okay, this is weird." So I addressed him with it. I'm in the kitchen. I'm already 3 sheets to the wind. And I had enough. I had a business where I didn't have to actually do much. So I just go around the house and drink. And so I addressed it with him. I said, "Jim, listen, man, there's a lot of weird magazines around the house, a hell of a lot of lotion. I don't know what's going on. There's blinds that are always closed, and every time I walk down the hallway, turn the light on, you dive down the hallway like a wild cat, turn it off." I was like, "What is going on here?" And he's like, "You don't understand, they're out there. And I was just like, I'd never seen that before. So I was just like, "What is going on?" So I was really mad at him, and I said, "Listen, this whole lotion thing has got to stop. It's everywhere." And he's just like, "Oh, man, well, look at you. So he turned the tables on me like a real drug addict. And he's just like, look at you. He goes, how many times have you pissed the couch? And I was just like, a few. What do you mean? And I was like, it's my couch. And he goes, you're always pissing on the couch. And you'd be pissing your pants if you were wearing any. And I was like, well, that's true. That's true. I do have a tendency to get warm when I drink. So I disrobe. That's a fact. I get hot and I get nude. So he said, I can solve that for you. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, the reason you pee your pants, well, if you had pants, you pee the couch. But the reason why you're shooting streams is because you can't stay awake. You're always passing out. He says, I can fix that. And I said, okay, what do you got? He goes, oh, here, come on. We're going to go get this thing called an 8-ball. And I was just like, 8-ball? We're going to shoot pool? Had no idea what it was. Man, I got an education. He basically became my sponsor. And we went behind this cheesy Mexican restaurant called Macayo's, and the guy came up there and he was just like, what do you want? And I said, we're interested in purchasing an 8-ball. And the guy was like, what the f-? And the other guy, he was over there slumped in the seat, and I was just like, I don't know what's wrong with him, but we need an 8-ball. And the guy was like, how much you got? And I was like, how much are they? He goes, $165. I said, that sounds like a bargain, $165. So I counted him out the money, and he goes, hey, you want another one? I see you got some more money in there. And I was just like, oh, that was a mistake. I didn't realize that you can't show them all your money you got. I've got a little envelope full of money, and the guy was like, whoa, yeah. I'll give you the second 8-ball for 1 1/4. And so I gave him 1 1/4, got that, and he goes, I'll give you a third one for 100. I was just like, okay. So I got that. And I was like, that guy took me to town. Yeah, let me tell you. I got an education quick. So we went home, and this guy was in there showing me the credit card and all the whole thing. And it was the first time in my life, and I had what's called a hot rail. Yeah. But the first time I ever, and man, my eyes bugged out of my head. I was turned beet red, and I had this beautiful stereo system that was going in the living room. But of course, we had to be in the closet when we were doing this. I didn't know why, but he was just like, no, not out here in the kitchen. No. And I was like, oh, in the bedroom, okay. And he's like, no. And we were, okay, in the bathroom. No. And all the way in the closet. And then we're down on our knees in the middle of the closet. And I was just like, this guy is out of his mind. So we did all that. But meanwhile, in the living room, I had this new album I had just gotten called Rock Steady by No Doubt. And it was playing in there. So we did all these hot rails. And I did the robot for 20 fucking minutes in one space with no clothes on. And I don't know what, but that's my jaw came out like a dresser drawer. It was like I started doing that right off the bat. And anyways, so there was a lot of stuff that happened following that really kind of went downhill. I learned the value of a TV for a bumpy poo, and it went down quick. I have never seen anything bring me to my knees the way dope did. And because I was a functioning alcoholic for a decade, 2 decades, and drinking 2/5 a day or 30 beers. Do you ever go camping? You drink 30 beers and you're just like still walking. And I've seen other people, like my mom, for example, not a drinker. She would drink a half a Coors Light and be like, oh, I better, I'm starting to feel this. And I'm just like, or my dad, my dad was a stone cold drug alcoholic, but my brother is not one of us. And he would be like, let's get a 6-pack and go golfing. I'd be like, a 6-pack? We're going to play one hole? Fuck out of here. 6-pack. Like it's a big deal, you know, they get a 6-pack. But yeah, the amount of drinking that I did up to that point was not normal by any person's standards, and I went to the hospital numerous times. But the drugs brought me to my knees, which is why I think Cocaine Anonymous is the greatest fellowship of all time. Because it wasn't until Kill Kid Anonymous entered the picture that I got sober, that I could hear. Because I heard the same thing when I was going to AA meetings and listening to old guys and stuff like that. But it wasn't until I got to Cocaine Anonymous that I actually started to hear what happened. Because I didn't reach Cocaine Anonymous after that. After that incident with Jim. I finally got rid of Jim. Somebody came and drug his car out of one of my garages, and there was black marks all over the place. And a few days after that, I was in a drug-induced. No, it was more than that. It was February 25th, 2005. So it was about 6 months after that. I was in a drug-induced coma. Wow, time flies, boy. When you're sun, moon, sun, moon, sun, moon, sun, moon, sun, moon, and you're like, what day is it? And then people come over. You grab a Coke can out of the trash. You know, what happened to Clinton? Yeah. Sometimes people say, you know, oh, I'm a drug addict too. I've been clean. I said, you ever smoke crack out of a Coke can? And they're just like, what the? I was like, yeah, get out of here. Get out of here. You're still wearing a watch. You're not done yet. you don't even know. You don't even know what we do. Get out of here, man. That's why I think Keep Cooking Anonymous is a secret group, because we have done some things for our dope that alcoholics will not do for booze. And if you don't know what those are, come see me after. we'll fill you in on what's possible. But anyways, it was about 6 months after that, February 25th, 2005. I remember the date because I spent some time in prison. But that particular day, I was a free man. And I woke up and was out of booze. It was a Sunday at about noon. And I was coked out of my mind. At this point, you know, it doesn't take long to become a full-blown dealer. You see your dealer every day, sometimes more than once a day. And so I decided I was going to go to Fry's, Food and Drug, and get some Jack Daniels to tide me over until the dealer got out of bed. So it's noon. And so I jumped on the Harley. I went down to Fry's. Do you have Fry's here, or is it Kroger's? Yeah, same. It's the same store. Yeah, over in Arizona they call them Fry's for some reason, but it's the same store. So I went to that. I went down there, and I walked inside, and I passed the threshold of the door, and they have fly fans. I don't know if you guys have those here, but they have fly fans in Arizona that blow really hard as you walk in, that keeps the air separate from the outside, and felt a little breezy, and so I reached back to check my wallet and felt nothing but ass. And it kind of like it dawned on me a little bit that I wasn't wearing any pants, but not enough. Not enough to like make a decision, you know, like this is a bad idea. So I was standing there with one hand on ass, and I was the only reason I know this really for facts is because of the security footage that they showed me after I got arrested. They're just like, look at you. You're standing there for like a whole minute. And I'm just like standing there. What I was thinking at the time was, where is it? Self-checkout. I can get there. Nobody will notice. I can bag my own stuff. Yeah, it's right over there. What about the little things on the top? Oh, I know how to do that. I can jigsaw, hacksaw, puzzle saw. I can do all that. So I'm working it out. And then it dawned on me, well, I don't have any debit card, no wallet, no pants. So I was like, oh, well, I got to go get my card. Not to go get pants. I had to go get my debit card. I wasn't worried about the clothing portion of it. So I went back out on the Harley. I jumped back on. By that time, the cops had showed up, and they put the V around it, and they're just like, you're freeze, you're not going anywhere. But I watched too many movies, so in my mind, I was Jason Bourne, so I immediately jumped on the bike and just took off. And I didn't know later, you know, I was only about a block or so from home. I could have made it home probably without too much trouble, because it took him a while to get over the shock over the fact that this guy just took off with no clothes on a Harley. And I got a pretty good head start, but I didn't do that. For some reason, I just got on the freeway, and I thought, I'm just going to run this out. And so that was on YouTube. You can't see it anymore. It was Madman on Bike. And it had the helicopter shot with me in the front, six-lane highway, and it's got the V, you know, the pyramid of cop cars that are behind. And there I am. I'm standing on the seat of my Harley doing like 100 miles an hour, long, blonde, luxurious hair that I used to have flowing in the wind back here, dick flopping. And I was having the time of my life. I was just like, I was having the time of my life. Madman on bike. Took us 2 years to get that off of YouTube. Yeah. For a long time, I was the mockery of Arizona. They would laugh and laugh. But they got that off of there. Finally. My little sister's an attorney, so that didn't hurt. But whatever the case, they got me. I went up and down the freeway I think 45, 50 minutes before, and I was coming up and down and getting off and coming back around, and they finally cornered me and they got me, and I started screaming police brutality because the pavement was hot and burning my privates, and I was like, I'm suing you, and we don't make any sense. And they carted me off to jail, and I spent the night in jail, woke up, and somebody, the cellmate, had covered me in toilet paper, which is pretty valuable. If you ever been to jail? Toilet paper is a valuable commodity in jail. I've spent some time in jail, and you see somebody using it for a pillow, and you're like, oh, no, we don't do that. We don't do that in jail, my friend. You get your ass kicked quick. Somebody had given me some toilet paper blanket, you know, because I apparently had passed out. But I woke up, and some guy was just like, bro, what happened to you? And I was just like, what do you mean? He's, look at you. And I went stumbling over there. I'm missing a tooth. And I had a black eye. I was all swollen and everything. I was just like a mess, a complete wreck. And I turned around. I looked that guy straight in the eye, and I said, listen, next time I'll take baseline. I won't take the freeway. And I started going in like 20-minute discussion on how that's where I went wrong. And I was dead serious. I was dead serious with this guy. So I lost my license to ride a motorcycle in the state of Arizona permanently. I was outlawed from by the judge, and he said, "You'll not get your regular driver's license back for X number of years, but you will never ride another motorcycle in Arizona again." And he said, "If I ever catch you riding a motorcycle, I'm going to throw away the key." And he was real mean. After. It was in 2016. I'd been sober 6 years, and this was 11 years after the incident. But I had been sober 6 years, and every year I went to that same judge to appeal. And in 2016, he lifted it after 11 years, and I went out 3 days later and bought a Harley, which is still sitting in my garage to this day. But anyways, whatever the case. That's what happens in sobriety, you know. You get to do cool things like that, and but I didn't get it, you know. And there's so many more incidents. That's just one example, but there's so many more examples of things which everybody in this room has similar situations where you came stone cold, face to face with your addiction, the consequences of it, and it just bounced off. It was just like a vending machine that won't take your dollar, and that's how I was. You ever seen those vending machines? You roll out the dollar bill, you iron it, put it between a book, and it would just be like, nope, 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 nope. And that's how I was with the program. No matter who told me about it, no matter what way they said it, what program they said it, how old the person was, it did not matter what it was. I could not hear what these people were saying. And I really don't have any explanation for why it happened. You know, for why that changed. I woke up one morning in April of 2010. I was in one of my flop houses. I used to have a house and a couple of other apartments and a studio and this, that over here, because my mom and my sisters were always trying to figure out where I was and call crisis center or whatever the hell. And I didn't want to be bothered. I just wanted to fade away. And there was, at this point, I was drinking rubbing alcohol. Because the Vietnamese liquor store across the street from this flop studio that I had, they wouldn't sell me no more liquor. I was so offended. I went over there on a Sunday morning, and they were, Ron, we don't sell you no more liquor. You yellow, scratchy, you're dirty, rave, you're crazy. Get out of here. And I was just like, how dare you? How dare you? She goes, put on pants. Put pants on. And I was just like, I'll go somewhere where I'm respected. So I didn't realize it was early. You know, you're not allowed to buy liquor in Arizona before a certain amount of time. But she was rude. So I went across the street to Fry's and tried to buy liquor there, and that's when they told me. They said, "Bro, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. You can't buy liquor on Sunday at 6 o'clock." Oh, okay. So then my brain light bulb went off, and I bought rubbing alcohol and drank that instead, and then developed a taste for it and ended up drinking that for quite some time, which I think you're supposed to die from. But I didn't. But I did test it, though, you know, like a good drug addict. You ever see those drug addicts today? You know, we're shooting stuff into our arms, and today they're like, "I don't know, is this gluten-free? I don't know." There's a lot of guys like that today. In Arizona, we got a bunch of those. We call them granola girls and soy boys in Arizona. But I tested it, though. I went outside around the side of the Fry's, and I poured a capful took a little capful of it. I was just to see if this is going to kill me, and I was like, "It sure feels like it." And just kept on doing it. But anyways, at this point, I was shooting, shooting heroin. I was injecting the rubbing alcohol into my veins because I couldn't drink it anymore, and it was several instances where I would see the snow, which is a whole nother ball game. But I got woken up because the apartment manager was worried. He thought I was dead because I hadn't moved for a couple days. So they took me to Community Bridges. They broke in and saw me comatose there on the floor. But they took me to Community Bridges, where you have the cheese sandwiches and the rubber mattresses. And there was no monogrammed robes. There was nobody wiping, wiping down for you or fixing you nice croissants or cool breakfasts. This was the bottom of the barrel crisis center, and they had come in and told me not to touch that. I had a bottle of rubbing alcohol right there, and the guy woke me up by hitting me in the solar plex, and. He said, "Don't," and I went to reach for it. He goes, "Don't reach for that or I'll cuff you." I was like, "Oh, okay." And then he turned around, I reached for it, cuffed me. And then I realized that there was a pillow stuck to my face. You ever had your sober thing? You know, something in your sober thing? My sober thing was my chiropractic pillow. It was my thing. You know, it didn't matter how much heroin I was shooting. I really felt I needed to stay in alignment. For some reason, I don't even. I can't explain that. I had a guy I was sponsoring. His Tommy Gum. Tommy Gum was his name. He lives in Seattle now, but he was a guy I sponsored for a long time, and he would relapse on occasion. One time he called me, and he was at the other end of town, rush hour traffic, and he's like, "Oh man, I relapsed. I need some help. I need help. I need help." And I was like, "Oh my God." So I called my sponsor, and he goes, "You got to go." And I was like, "I was hoping you wouldn't say that." And so I called Tommy back. I was like, "I'm on my way." So I drove out there. 2 hours it took me to get there in rush hour traffic. And there he is, kicked out of his apartment, sitting on the side of the grassy knoll. And he was like, "Oh, my God." And I was like, "What's going on, man?" And he told me the story. And I said, "Well, get your stuff. We're gonna go check you into a treatment center, and we'll get you back on the right track." And he's like, "All right." So he gets his backpack full of dirty clothes, and he gets his laundry basket. It's got a hole in the side this big. And I was just like, "What do you? No, we're not taking that." And he goes, "No, it's my laundry basket." And I was like, "Laundry basket? We're not taking that. You ain't even got any laundry in it. Leave that piece of shit." And he's like, "It's my thing, man." And I thought of my chiropractic pillow, and I was like, "Okay, bring the laundry basket." That's his thing, you know? It's your thing. And I've never sponsored a guy that didn't have his thing. There was like something that he really needed to feel like he was okay. But that's what I had. I had a chiropractic pillow. It had a little hole in the middle where you're supposed to lay your head so you can get in perfect alignment. Even if you're shooting heroin, even if you're on high on meth, you need to make sure your neck doesn't get out of whack. So... But if you drink a whole bunch of rubbing alcohol, that little hole becomes a swimming pool for puke. And so that seems to cement, so that was cemented onto my head, Which is interesting because Crisis Center does not have pillows. It's rubber mattresses only, but I brought my own. It was, they tried to get it off, and I was like, so they said, just bring him with it. Just bring him with it. I remember the cops saying that. They were disgusted with me. They said, bring him with it. Put him on the gurney. Take him to Crisis Center. And so they pulled me in there. I woke up, and they had cut my hair to get the pillow off. They had cut my hair right here. And so I had hair down to here on this side. And I had hair, Dorothy Hamill, on this side. And they got me sober for 4 days. And then they took me to this place called Solution, which was this, like, halfway house. And I had no clothes because I went in nude. And so they said, go to that house over there, that little shop over there, and get some clothes. So I go over there thinking, oh, this is going to be great. I just pick what I want. There's nothing in there. There was, like, a 8-year-old's Superman underoos, which I squeezed onto my balls, and then they had like these giant pants, these shorts pants, these jean pants. So I got those, but no belt. So the guy gave me a rope, and I put the rope around my waist, and I was like, okay, I got that now. And then I put these flip flops on, and they had this long sleeve shirt that was for like an 11-year-old maybe, and I squeezed that onto my 137-pound body, and it turned into a 3/4 shirt, one of those stylish baseball type shirts, and that was my outfit for like 3 months. I'm not kidding you. That's all I wore. I had glasses with missing one arm, and I had the glasses on that, and I would come into the meetings, and they would be like, oh. And this guy who was the manager of the treatment center, the halfway house, his name was Bob Finnegan, and he the first time he saw me, they laughed in my face. And he told his other guy, Mike, that was his assistant manager, he's like, this guy does not have a chance. And that burned me. That burned me. I was just like, I will show this mother. Here, I'm one tooth missing, you know, hair up in a ponytail, but it was only like off to the side like that. I had this ponytail of draggedy-ass, raggled, mangled hair and just chopped over here and wearing my little underoo panties. And I was just like, I will show this, man. I was so mad. And they thought, oh, this guy needs to, you need to work in the bathrooms. And so I cleaned the bathrooms. You're supposed to only have the chore for a week, and then you move to another chore. I had that chore the entire time I was there, 99 days. And then I did no days off. And I went to that meeting. I wore those same underoos and my same rope belt and finally got a job. They let me off the property to go get a job. And I don't understand what happened. This guy named Jeff, he got me when I was inside the treatment center, and he said, I'm going to sponsor you. And he said, what do you do? And I was like, I don't, nothing. And he's like, let me tell you a little bit about myself. And this is why I think the stories are so important. Because this, one of the first things that he said to me is like, let me tell you a story about me. In Santa Monica, I had a brand new Harley, and I took it over there. We did this. I burned the bottom of my feet, and it's a big, long story. And I was just like mesmerized. And if he had not told me that, I don't think I would have listened to another word he said. But I did. And I worked the steps with him. And I worked the fourth step honestly. Every single detail in there. He said, I don't care what's in your fourth step. I don't care how many cats you kicked in the face. I don't care how many dicks you sucked. He just went off on the fourth step. And I was like, well, I didn't do either of those things. But did you? What the hell? How would you even think of that? My God. But I did it. I did the fourth step exactly like it's supposed to be done. Imagine that. You know, 7 years I've been dicking around in and out of the rooms. You know, I used to tell people, well, I was in 4 months clean, and then, you know, I relapsed. Right off the bat, this guy told me, stop saying that. Stop lying to people. You didn't relapse. You ain't never even quit, you stupid ass. And he just busted me down. And he was just like, get on the fourth step. Do it now. And we're going to do the third step prayer. We did this and that. And then we did sixth step, seventh step. And I was like, so we're going to wait a while to do the eighth step? And he was just like, no, we're doing it now. And we got that done. And I made this list of people, and I had to go make amends to my mom, but he wouldn't let me do it because I wasn't ready yet. And he goes, look at you. You're in no shape to make amends. I've been sober like 9 months now. And he's just like, you shut your mouth when you're talking to me. And I was just like, oh, my God. This guy's out of his mind, you know. So I did it. I did what he told me, every single thing he told me, and I became a big book nut job and probably should have been locked up for about the first year. The first couple of people I sponsored, I probably almost killed them because I had no idea what I was doing, but I was out of my mind convinced. And they called me up, and there's a problem going on. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm just like, yes, we do know what we're going to do. I'm on my way. We're going to a meeting. And then on my way there, I'd call my sponsor and be like, what the fuck? And I'd pick up the guy, and the sponsor would text me, I'm not going to be at that meeting tonight. And this kid would be crying. He's like, what are we going to do? And I was like, I don't know. I hope there's somebody at this meeting that can fucking help us. But we come running up, find somebody with a white beard, and be like, hey, you look like you know what you're doing. What a fiasco. But it was that spirit of, you know, I'm going to do it. You know, I didn't care. I'm just going to do it. I read the book backwards and frontwards, and I was like, I didn't care what happened. We were going to go down together, if that's what it was. And it worked, and I stayed sober. And then a year went by, and then 2 years went by, and 3 years went by. And then in 3 years, I got married. I got married in my third year of sobriety. And I was not well yet, I don't think, because she was crazy. And it was the weirdest thing. That's not her. Yes, I just realized that they might be thinking that's you. That's not her. No. No, it was a quickie thing, and love overnight, and I don't know. I know I have a lot of sponsees. They go to rehab, and they meet the love of their life. You know, it's in the first 60 days. I was like, I didn't even know what my own name was for a year. What do you mean? And they're like, oh yeah, 60 days. And this part wakes up, and they're just like, oh yeah. I'm like, what the hell's going on? And they're all fucking each other. Yeah, that wasn't the case for me at all. That wasn't the case. The girls in there saw one look at me and they were just like, what? No way. Had the ponytail coming out the side, missing a tooth. I was like, hey, what's up? Why are you so shallow? You don't like to... I forgot what I was even talking about now. But no, in 3 years I got married. And thought it was the right thing to do, and my sponsor told me not to do it, did it anyway. And one of the few times that I went against his advice, because I was like, you don't understand love. Yeah. You know. And then I went on that weird thing that you do to sponsors when you get to a certain age, and you've been sober for a while, and you're like, well, you're good with the steps, but you're not a therapist. You know, you don't understand love. You're not a relationship counselor. And let me tell you, never say that to your sponsor. Never say that to your sponsor. He already knows it. But whatever the case. So anyways, I've been married for about a year, 5 years sober at this point, been married for about a year, was engaged for a little while, and then been married for a year. Come home on a Tuesday afternoon, whole house is cleaned out. Thought we got robbed. Gave her a call. She said, no, I got all your shit. I'm not coming back. And I was like, what? I've been here before. I've done this before. This is the... I was like, what's going on here? And I was... That was a rough moment, you know? But I've been sober for 5 years, and I've been doing the right thing. Service work. You go to meetings. You do your job. You know, we go do chair meetings, and we go to the area meeting, and we show up every single month, and we do what we're supposed to do, and we be of service. And I was a secretary for Cocaine Anonymous of Arizona. I was chairing meetings over here and speaking over here and doing what I'm supposed to do. And so when that happened, and I got off the phone with her, the next call was to my friends. And I said, you're not going to believe this. And I called my own sponsor. His name is Sam. I called my own sponsor. He hung up on me. Thought I was fucking around. I said, hey, you're not going to believe it. I just got home from work. It's 4:30 in the afternoon. Whole house is empty. She left. And he's just like, stop fucking around, fuckface. He hung up on me. He calls me fuckface all the time. It's like a term of endearment at this point. But that's his word for me. Just it's no matter what, it's fuckface. So, but anyway, I called him back and I was like, don't hang up, I'm not playing. And he's just like, you better not be playing around, fuckface. And I was like, I'm not joking. That's what's going on. He goes, all right, I'll call you right back. So, and then boom, he shows up. Boom, another guy shows up. Boom, some lady shows up. And all next thing you know, there's all these people. And they were just like, we're going to do this. We're going to get this together. We're going to pack up the house. We're going to sell the house. We're going to do whatever we need to do. And you're going to be fine. And I was just fine. And then 2 years later, through therapy, outside sources of therapy, I realized that I did not even like her. I did not want to know what I was doing. I was like, I should have done my therapist's name is Jan. She's like an 80-year-old lady. And I told her not long after that, I said, I probably should have started seeing you right away. I don't think I should have waited 5 years to come to therapy. And she's just like, nobody's stopping you. Typical therapist thing to say. But and that's been a real blessing. In the last couple of years, Adrian and I have been engaged for a couple of years now. But before that happened, we took some time and tried to figure out who we are. And people ask all the time, the greatest gift of being sober is sober, right? I was like, no, that's like the first thing you do is stop using drugs. I said, everything else is the gift that happens after that, the ability to see who I really am. And that's the true gift. I know what I like. I know what I want to do with my life. I know who my friends are. I don't say yes to things, not very often anyway, that I don't want to do. Sometimes I do. When you make a mistake, you can say it, and you can ask for forgiveness and apologize. And it's a miraculous thing that happens in the program of Cocaine Anonymous over time. What time is it? I don't know what time it is. My watch is Arizona. It's 8:10. Yeah, so I'm about done. Yeah. I'm about done talking. I don't know what I don't know what time it is. I want to reset my watch, but I'm a weird Rain Man-y way, don't know if I can make it right again after that. So, I don't even know what I'm talking about right now. But whatever the case, that I think that is the greatest gift that sobriety can give is an awareness of one's self. And what a person wants to be in life, because it's for me, it's not about staying sober anymore. I don't struggle to stay sober. I'm not like white knuckling, resisting the urge to stop and get dope. I don't even think about it anymore. It's the actual imperfections and the emotions of life that bring the greatest toll, which is really where the big book comes in, where our sponsor comes in. Because if we take a perceived hurt or wrong, fancied or real, like the big book says, and then I attach some kind of emotion to it, then I have a resentment, and that's like my little magical recipe. And then I don't like you anymore, and then there's a me in between you and me. There's too much of me in there, and then I can't see what I'm supposed to see, and it's that becomes a wreck. But being in Cocaine Anonymous is something that alleviates that, and I will be forever grateful for Cocaine Anonymous. Thank you for giving me a chance at life, a second chance at life. I snatched it up like the last biscuit at Christmas dinner, and I'm grateful for it. Thank you. Yeah.